Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past the hour, following the latest news, a preview of the 2017 North American International Auto Show from Detroit Free Press auto critic and MSU J School alumnus Mark Phelan.
The biggest trend that we're going to see is SUVs. The growth in that type of vehicle sales has been incredible. It's outstripped what any automaker expected, and we're just going to see more and more of it.
Later, James Clift from the Michigan Environmental Council looks ahead to green issues facing Michigan in the new year.
Continue investing in renewable energy, continuing investing in energy efficiency. These are the mechanisms that are helping try to keep our energy costs low, and we're going to continue to invest in those moving forward.
MSU Today begins at 4:06. Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, the 2017 North American International Auto Show opens to the public this weekend, and for several years now, Detroit Free Press auto critic Mark Phelan has graciously carved some of his time from a very busy schedule to give us show highlights in general and to discuss green initiatives in the auto industry. Mark, first, Happy New Year to you and yours, and thank you, as always, for your time.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me back.
Mark, before we get into some of the broader issues that I'd like to talk about, let's begin with this year's auto show. It starts this weekend, January 14th, the public part of it. It runs through Sunday, January the 22nd. What are some of the highlights for our listeners?
Well, the biggest trend that we're going to see is SUVs. The growth in that type of vehicle sales has been incredible. It's outstripped what any automaker expected, and we're just going to see more and more of it. General Motors will have a new family-carrying SUV, a new version of the Traverse that they've been selling for a couple of years that's bigger but also lighter and more fuel-efficient, and we will see SUVs of virtually every size and type, and we'll see them getting the kind of fuel economy that frankly was unimaginable a few years ago, thanks to lighter weight and engineering advances.
So the fact that there's a great demand for SUVs doesn't necessarily militate against efficiency and green technology?
No, these are going to have all the same technologies you'd see in a compact car, and many of them are much smaller than people think of. The fuel economy of the new generation of SUVs is light years better than what we got in the past because of new technologies, but also because a lot of these vehicles are much smaller than what people may think of when they hear the term SUV. We're not talking Chevy Suburbans and Ford Expeditions alone anymore. There are a lot of these that are based on the same mechanical systems as cars like the Chevy Sonic or the Honda Fit, so that they're small, subcompact SUVs, and they get more than 30 miles a gallon on the highway. Fuel economy figures that people couldn't imagine a few years ago, but they also give people the height and the all-wheel drive that are the things people really want most out of an SUV.
Are we going to see any battery technology married with any of these SUVs at the auto show?
At this show, I don't think there's going to be much hybrid activity where these SUVs are concerned, mostly because the market is still growing and people are just getting into it with their early models. There have been concepts of battery-powered SUVs. Jaguar's got a very interesting battery-powered concept that they say they're going to build in a couple of years, but we're probably still in the first wave of introductions of these vehicles, and once they've had them on the ground for a couple of years, then we'll see hybridization and battery power coming on in a big way on the SUV side as well.
Last year, we talked about what a wonderful year 2015 was in the for auto sales. 2016 was another banner year. What are you hearing about 2017, Mark?
Well, nobody is betting that we're going to get that lucky 3 years in a row, but there is generally a sense of confidence that sales should remain strong. We're not expecting another record, certainly, but another good year over 16 million seems likely.
You recently wrote an excellent column. It's called Six Technologies to Watch in 2017. It was December 12th in the Free Press, not that long ago. One of the things, and we could talk about each of those technologies, but one that struck me, because as you know, I drive a Chevy Volt, and there are a lot of new electric technologies coming out in 2017. There were some in 2016 as well. But you said that if EVs don't move into the mainstream this year, meaning 2017, you have to wonder whether the technology will ever make the leap. Why did you write that?
Well, first and foremost, because of the Chevrolet Bolt, which is a pure electric car, not a plug-in hybrid like your Volt. The Bolt with a B is pure electric, and it can go 238 miles on a charge, according to EPA tests. That's the kind of range that people have not been able to get from electric vehicles before. People who were worried that an electric wouldn't let them get far enough to, you know, drive perhaps from Detroit to Lansing for a football game, for instance, and back. The Bolt takes care of that problem, and it's far more affordable than other electric vehicles with, you know, with really long ranges. A Tesla that can go 240 miles will cost you $70,000 or $80,000. The Bolt, after the tax incentives are applied to it, starts at under $30,000. So that's really taking the pure battery electric car and making it appealing to a much wider group of people. And if they don't say, yes, I'll take a chance on electric now, you have to wonder, will they ever? The other side of the coin is that we are also seeing more plug-in hybrids like the Volt that you've got, which are cars that have batteries that let them go 15, 20, 30, in the case of your Volt, 50 miles on a battery charge. And then if you need to go farther, there's a gasoline engine that is available also. So between those two, longer range at lower price for pure electric cars and a wider range of plug-in hybrids, this does seem like the time when electrics have something to offer to a very wide slice of the buying audience now.
Mark, we've got a new administration in Washington, and there's a lot of speculation. And right now, a lot of things are unpredictable. But what may a Trump administration, what are you hearing? What may a Trump administration mean to the auto industry? And how are the auto executives positioning themselves for this new administration?
Well, unpredictable, the word that you used, would sum up just about everybody's first response. I don't think anyone in the industry really knows what to expect from the administration. There is the pressure to not import cars. There's, you know, been the complaints about companies that build new plants in Mexico and other countries. Will there be more of that? Will there perhaps be an import tariff, which would be a huge change in policy from the way America has traded historically for the last, you know, 50 years. Something like that could have a very severe impact on sales, pushing them down. Car dealers are worried that if there was a, say, 20% import tax on cars, that could reduce annual sales by a couple of million units. That's one aspect that people are uncertain about. On the other hand, they're also uncertain about the direction of fuel economy and emissions regulations, because, you know, Mr. Trump does not seem to be particularly persuaded by the evidence about global climate change. Much of the emissions regulation has been, and fuel economy improvements have been specifically to reduce climate change. So will he try to reverse that trend?
Yeah, so the auto executives are in some ways feeling a little bit whipsawed right now. I mean, what do you make of Ford's recent decision to forego a plant in Mexico and instead add 700 jobs down in Flat Rock?
It's very difficult to be sure. On the one hand, the plant in Mexico that they were building, a lot of analysts thought that they were over-optimistic last year when they announced that they were going to add that plant. And it was building Focus cars, which, as we were talking about earlier, the action, the growth in the market is SUVs, not small cars. So whether Ford was actually going to need a plant that could build another couple of 100,000 small cars seemed like a very open question to people. So it's very difficult to be certain how much of that is a response to the pressure from President-elect Trump and how much of it is a response to the trends in the market. We do know that they are going to add production of some hybrid vehicles to Flat Rock, which is very interesting. One of the vehicles they named specifically was a Mustang that has some hybrid technology. That's a very good example of how electrification and hybrid technology is going to move really into just about every corner of the market. Ford is now talking about hybrid versions of their classic muscle car, the Mustang, and of the F-150 pickup, because they want to improve fuel economy in all of those vehicles. Even if the administration reduces the incentives for regulations for higher fuel economy, all of these car companies have to sell vehicles around the world, so they would still have to develop the same technologies. Because of that, the Detroit automakers are a little bit reluctant to see the clock rolled too far back, I think, because in the past they had to develop one kind of vehicle for sale in the United States and another kind for sale around the rest of the world, when everybody else that they were competing with was only developing vehicles to meet the full world's needs and selling them here as well. So there are downsides to lower regulation, even from the point of view of some industry people who generally don't care for regulation. It's a very difficult path to see what they expect or what they want. I think a little bit of moderation in the targets for fuel economy would probably make them happy, but I don't think they want to see a reversal of direction by any means.
Well, you answered my next question about some moderation in CAFE standards to counterbalance some of the issues related to trade and to domestic production. But it seems like the auto executives are trying their best right now to sort of feel out this administration and at least to position themselves so they can be in a position of some negotiation.
Yes, and they know that this administration is not going to be shy about pushing them. So they're trying very hard to read where's the wind coming from, how can they take advantage of the things that Mr. Trump says that he wants them to do, and perhaps use that as a way to get leverage for some of the things that they want to do. The fact that Ford announced that it was not building a plant in Mexico at the same event where it said it was going to add jobs to build hybrid vehicles in Michigan could be an example of that. They gave Mr. Trump something that he could immediately claim as a victory, whether it really was related to anything that he had said or not in the plant decision. And they said at the same time, look, we're building these hybrid vehicles. We need support for that as well. So I think they're going to try to figure out, what is the middle ground that they can walk.
I'm talking with Detroit Free Press auto critic Mark Phelan. Mark, a question that's often occurred to me, and I should have asked you this a couple of interviews ago, but when you talk about fuel efficiency, when you talk about reduced emissions, when you talk about battery and other green technologies in the auto industry that have happened over the last 10 to 15 to 20 years, how much of that would have happened without some government intervention and oversight?
Oh, the government direction is responsible for the vast majority of it. If gasoline is cheap or if prices fluctuate wildly, as they tend to do, people don't change their buying habits radically. Or they may change their buying habits for a year or two when gasoline costs $4 a gallon, and when it goes back down to $2 a gallon, they decide that they want big vehicles that use much more fuel. That kind of inconsistency makes it almost impossible for automakers to plan. The investment cost and the investment time to develop a new engine, a new family of vehicles, is immense. So what they want more than anything else, really, is predictability. And that was one of the great, I think, victories, accomplishments of the Obama administration. They came up with a series of very challenging fuel economy standards going out to 2025, but because it was a roadmap all the way out to 2025, the automakers could see where they had to get and come up with a long-term plan and a strategy to reach those goals. So even though the goals were very challenging, they were willing to take them on because they believed we know what the end point of this set of regulations is. So consistency is very important, and consistency drove much of the move to higher fuel economy, because otherwise buying habits for people will change radically from one year to another based on the price of fuel. But the regulations can be a kind of a moderating factor.
Mark, we're just about out of time here, and I wanted to touch on autonomous vehicles, but that we'll have to do that. We could do a whole interview on something fun like the where are we going with autonomous vehicles. I know you've addressed that in your columns. I would encourage my listeners to read Mark Phelan in the Free Press. He is the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. Mark, enjoy your time at the auto show. I know you already had the media preview, but you'll be spending a lot of time down there. And as always, thank you so much for spending some time on Greening of the Great Lakes.
It is my pleasure. Thank you.
WKAR. You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, 2016 ended on a very positive note for the Michigan Environmental Council. With us to talk about Michigan's new energy reform legislation and other key focus areas in 2017 is frequent guest on this program, James Clift. James is the policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. James, first, Happy New Year, and great to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
Well, let's get right to the implementation of the energy legislation. First of all, sounds like MEC was pleased with that legislation.
We were. I mean, after all of this discussion of do we repeal things, do we go backwards, we took steps forward, and we think that's very positive. Continue investing in renewable energy, continuing investing in energy efficiency. These are the mechanisms that are helping try to keep our energy costs low, and we're going to continue to invest in those moving forward. So we were happy with the end product.
There was one thing that you battled, you and other organizations, and that were to continue incentives for residential energy users to use solar energy. A lot of our listeners may not be familiar with that particular dimension.
Yeah, so we've had a provision in place which have allowed customers to spin their meters backwards when they put solar on. So if they put energy onto the grid, they basically get the same thing they're paying for energy when they do that. And over time, you know, you can't have everybody do that. So, and there was caps in the current program that was up to a certain percentage of a utility's load could come under those programs. And we expected the utilities would probably hit those caps in maybe the next 3 or 4 years. So under this law, what it says is it directs the commission to start to study what tariff makes sense to replace the current. If you're going to replace the current one, how would you design a rate in the future? And I think around the country, what you have is a lot of people talking about, well, what you want to do is blend the concept of time of use rates in with net metering, which is when are you putting energy on the grid? If you're putting it in the middle of a hot summer afternoon, then you should be getting big money for it because that's when energy is the most valuable. And if you're taking it off at 5 in the morning, then you should be paying less. So maybe blending those two concepts together to make sure that we continue to encourage people to set up those systems, but also encourage them to do energy efficiency. So if their systems are generating electricity on a hot summer day, put as much as possible onto the grid to share with your neighbors and to avoid the cost of utilities having to go out and buy high-cost energy during those times. So that change, though, is not coming overnight. We've actually, current programs will operate for at least another 2.5 years as we develop those tariffs, then slowly implement them with the utility. So it's a good deal now. This is actually a great time to continue to jump into those programs for the next 2.5 years. But then eventually we will transition into this new tariff.
What about the energy efficiency programs? I'm familiar with those that Consumers Energy has implemented. I know DTE has some. But how will those, will those be expanded? Will those continue as is?
Well, what we did is the standard is the same. So they have to reduce demand by at least 1% a year on the electricity side, a little less on the natural gas side. What we did is put a few sweeteners in there where if the utilities improve their performance, we've got their ability to earn some more financial bonuses. So we're actually hoping our rate has been in the 1.2, 1.3% range. We've got a little added bonus if they get up to 1.5%. So we're hoping that they get above that number sometime in the next few years.
Now, on the renewable energy standard, it's been set now at 15% by 2020. Good move forward, but a lot of people would say, wish it could have been more.
Yeah, and again, given the price of renewable energy, it is the best deal in the state today. So we really kind of view that as a floor, is that the utilities should be at least at 15%. But part of the new law is also to, for them to come in with comprehensive plans before the commission. And we'll be arguing that, that it actually should be more than 15% in those comprehensive plans. Once you compare it to the other things that they want to invest in, if it's cheaper than natural gas and they want to build a new natural gas plant, we'll be arguing for more than 15%. But it's nice to have in the law a floor. So you
right.
can't, you've got to keep moving forward. You can't just sit on your hands like they have been for the last year or so.
True, and it's clearly a step forward. There's no question about that.
It is.
Let's turn to another hot issue. That's that Line 5, Enbridge Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac. We're waiting on a couple of reports that are supposed to be coming out in June. Where's the Michigan Environmental Council? You're probably monitoring that process.
We are very closely. I mean, the key is you've got a 63-year-old line in the Straits, and I think everyone admits, hey, eventually you want to replace that line. You're putting the Great Lakes at risk. So these reports will look at, hey, what are the reasonable alternatives to that line? So they'll come out this summer. They'll take public comment on those reports. But hopefully those reports will help outline, hey, what's the next move for Michigan? And what's the next move for getting that pipeline out of there? What's the next move for protecting the Great Lakes and moving forward? It won't happen overnight, but we're hoping this report kind of gives us a roadmap for how do you get those pipes out of the water? How do you better protect the Great Lakes moving forward?
Well, I'm talking environmental issues, looking back a little bit at 2016, looking ahead to 2017 with James Clift. He's a policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. James, we were talking about the two reports related to the Enbridge Line 5 that are due out in June. One is a risk assessment, and one looks at some alternatives. A little bit more detail for our listeners on the difference between the two reports.
Yeah, so the risk assessment is really looking at that. What's that worst-case scenario? What if the pipeline was to break, and let's say in the winter months when there's ice cover, you couldn't address it immediately, you couldn't grab any of that oil? What if the mechanisms to close off the lines didn't work properly? We've seen that a lot around the country where in Kalamazoo River, it was 19 hours before they knew that
right.
was broken. The, down in the Gulf of Mexico, of course, how long it took to close off that one. So what if those mechanisms don't work? What is that impact of the Great Lakes that we would expect to see? You know, and again, the University of Michigan and other people have done some studies on what does that look like. This will hopefully reaffirm those findings that it is a multi-billion dollar threat that is out there. And then the second report, of course, then looks at, okay, what else could we do to get those lines out of the water? Is there existing infrastructure we could use? You know, other pipelines that are currently in the system. You know, you look at Michigan, we continue to use less oil products every year. Our sale of gasoline has went down about 1% a year. So as we start to reduce that use and as maybe as electric cars take over, does that reduction become even more? Do we need that line anymore, or could other existing lines be adequate to serve our needs moving forward? That's one of the alternatives the report will be looking at. So again, what are the different other ways we could deliver oil, make it available to the customers who use it and propane, but in a way that doesn't provide that same threat to the Great Lakes.
Probably two of the most anticipated environmentally related reports in recent memory, at least for the great state of Michigan.
I think so. And again, they're comprehensive reports, and hopefully we'll provide good detail on what those alternatives look like.
We talked about pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac. As long as we're talking about water, I know one of the things on your agenda for 2017 is not just Flint, but looking at the Michigan water infrastructure in general.
Yeah, I think, there's been a lot of attention toward Flint, and we don't want to take our focus off of Flint. You know, there's some federal money that's come in. I think we should match it with some state money. Let's address the infrastructure problems we see there. But then let's not stop there and think, oh, Flint was just an anomaly, that's the only place there is a risk to drinking water infrastructure. Let's look around the rest of the state and ask the question, well, where else are there lead service leads in a system? Do we know where they are? And do really important to us is, do the customers, do residents of the state of Michigan know the state of their infrastructure? Is there a lead lead going to their home or their business? Or is their community like Flint, where they didn't know exactly where they are? And should they be receiving some materials that say, hey, there is one there, or there's not one there? And if there is one there or they don't know, maybe a recommendation that those families use filters until we answer that question and get those lead pipes out of the system so that we can kind of guarantee that we're providing safe drinking water to all the residents of Michigan.
Now, aren't there a couple cities in Michigan, and I think Lansing may be one of them, that have been pretty aggressive with respect to any lead within the water infrastructure?
Yeah, so Lansing discovered theirs about 10 years ago, and we have now replaced all the lead service leads in Lansing. I think just this in the last 6 months, I think, we finished that job. It was an expensive undertaking. It's not one that you want to rush through it, so you do it kind of periodically over time. But we've made that investment in the system, and we can now kind of, with assurance, tell the residents of the city of Lansing anyway and the Born Water and Light system that they're protected. And a few other cities have done that. But a lot of cities are more in the Flint category. They still have that old infrastructure in the ground. Sometimes they know where the lead leads are, sometimes they don't. And again, making sure we get information to the public so that they can manage their risk. Because if you don't know, or if you had a lead lead, what the city of Lansing did, I thought made perfect sense. Provide free filters to the customers, help them make sure they can get them installed. In Flint, that's been a little bit of a challenge on different faucets that are out there, making sure you can install those filters and making sure they have safe drinking water for their families.
We're talking about a variety of environmental issues with James Clift, who's the policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Something that we've covered on this program with Joan Rose and others, but the septic systems, not only in the state of Michigan, I mean, we're going to talk about that, but nationally, part of the eroding infrastructure that a lot of people, I have a septic tank. Have I had it checked properly? I have it pumped, but have I had it checked in the last 15 years? No.
Yeah, so I think this is key. And really looking across the state, where when we look at drinking water, we look at two things, the infrastructure to deliver it, but you're also looking at your source water protection. Is your groundwater safe? You know, if there's leaking septic systems in your area, are they potentially contaminating groundwater or local rivers and streams? So making sure that everybody in Michigan is doing their part in protecting our water resources, both those people on public systems and people on private systems. So we're going to make another run at basically adopting a uniform septic code for Michigan. We're basically the only state that doesn't have that uniform code. But even more importantly, a periodic inspection requirement, either at the time of sale or every 10 years or something like that, to make sure those systems are in place. The time of sale is kind of nice because it protects new home buyers.
Right.
And that's kind of nice. You don't want to buy a home and then a year later find out that, oh, you've got a $5,000 drain field that you've got to replace. I think part of this program would probably then to be maybe set up a fund that could provide low interest loans to somebody that maybe couldn't afford to upgrade their system. They find that it's in failure, making sure that we have funds available for them to upgrade those systems so that either if they want to sell their homes or continue to use it, there's funds available at a reasonable interest rate.
Well, let's bring it home here for people like me. If I wanted to do the right thing ahead of selling my home, for example, and I wanted to have my septic system inspected, I mean, where do I go?
Yeah, so Right now, there is 11 counties in Michigan that require an inspection at the time of sale, and all of those counties have, like, list of authorized inspectors.
I see, so you go to your...
So you can either go to one of those lists that are probably in maybe a surrounding county if your county's not doing it, but I think your public health department, probably the best place to go to ask that question. Yeah. Again, more and more of those counties are getting involved. It's kind of a public health county issue. And a lot of them, what they do is they have a list of authorized inspectors. So that's a good place to start.
Great. We cover recycling on this program quite a bit. It's no secret Michigan's recycling level is not what it is in some neighboring Great Lakes states. One of the things on your agenda is to increase recycling efforts, probably working with the Michigan Recycling Coalition.
Working with them and the Snyder administration, they have put a fair amount of effort behind trying to get Michigan's recycling rate up there because they realize that it is both good for preserving landfill space and for economic development opportunities. Those companies that use recycled materials want a guaranteed waste stream. So how do we help them make sure that that's going to be available in Michigan?
Yeah, and I think there are some funds that the Snyder administration has made available to the Michigan Recycling Coalition and others to get the word out there.
Again, a little bit more is kind of tracking what we have and making sure that the counties get more involved in the planning process to make sure that we're creating those good recycled material waste streams.
We've got 30 seconds left, Jays, but something quick. I wasn't aware of this. Create an Office of Outdoor Recreation within the DNR.
Actually, it could be the DNR, could be the MEDC. The idea is, hey, we want to kind of build on the Pure Michigan campaign. Let's create an Office of Outdoor Recreation, really sell to people in Michigan and around the country the opportunities that are available in Michigan.
Always interesting to talk, and there are a number of others. The environmental slate, the agenda, is going to keep you very busy in 2017, James.
It always does.
I've been talking with James Clift. He is the policy director for the Michigan Environmental Council. Always appreciate your time, James.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. WKAR.
Michigan State University will recognize and honor Martin Luther King Jr. with a campus-wide celebration January 15th and 16th. This is the 37th annual event. Ignacio Andrade, Community Outreach Coordinator and Student Liaison at the Office for Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives, is leading this year's celebration. Thanks for coming on, Ignacio.
Thank you for having me.
The theme for this year's commemoration is the Art of Nonconformity, Dissent and Civil Discourse. And the sub-theme is Our Lives Begin to End, the Day We Become Silent About Things That Matter. It's no surprise that currently there is some divisiveness within our country, so these themes feel especially relevant. What do you hope this year's programming accomplishes with these themes?
Absolutely. On point with the relevance, not only locally, but nationally. And the theme is intended to help spark vigorous conversations from across the political spectrum, if you will, about real issues and how they play out in our local communities, in particular with a focus on how it impacts MSU, faculty, staff, of course, but then with a particular emphasis on students and how they really experience the local and national movements of chatter, I'll say, about these issues in a different way than previous generations because of the ability for them to stay so connected on a constant 24/7 basis almost through social media and creating their own media via those routes, I think is important to really what we're using this year is hashtag break the silence on issues that are important to you. And that could be left, right, and center, on the table, under the table, whatever it is that you really feel passionate about, that you feel that our community needs to know about and and have real conversations about, and sometimes tough conversations about issues that are almost taboo, left off the table all too often. And in this political climate, given the transition and presidencies, there have been, leading up to this, a lot of things that have been said. Some are from across the spectrum, and some are regrettable in the context of attacks, can be perceived as attacks from one group or the other, or one person or the other. And this is intended to help help remind us that we all may be different, but we all make up what it is we call community, and we need to help shed the concept of those people over there, because those people over there are really our people. They're our community members, and we need to have those tough conversations, and we're hoping that this will spark some of those conversations to be put on the forefront of us moving forward locally and on our part of the globe, but also across the nation. This is the type of work and conversations and community building that needs to happen, we feel.
You mentioned students and kind of their unique ways of communicating and their constant communication. A big aspect of the commemoration each year is the involvement of students, both college and high school students. Can you talk a little bit about their role in the celebration?
The students are absolutely essential to the celebration. Right from the get-go, there would be no celebration, or at least it wouldn't be 37 years old here on campus, if a student at the time, a graduate student back in 1980, I guess it would be now, decided it was time that MLK be honored here on campus in our community. And that was even before the national movement. And so as oftentimes MSU is ahead of the curve on many issues, as students are often at that cutting edge. And so right from the beginning up to modern times, students now play a key role on the planning throughout the entire semester. We have a planning committee that they are absolutely crucial in being able to identify options and make decisions about what the commemorative celebration will look like on behalf of the entire community. And so that student voice is loud, and it is present at all along the semester planning, and at the day of, especially, we feature all kinds of students being highlighted in presentations. Pachakacha presentations in particular are being highlighted at the Student Leadership Conference from diverse racial, ethnically, gender-wise, you name it. Folks are all, these students are from all makes, and they are discussing issues that are important to them. And so these issues are happen to be current issues that our country has also elevated to a point of debate and importance. And so we're looking forward to having the student perspective articulated very loud that day, and giving them a platform to be able to develop as leaders, because they are leaders already, and we know that we will continue on that path to be our community leaders once they graduate. And they may come back to MSU or go anywhere around the world, as Spartans often do, but we know that their commitment to their communities is second to none. And so we really want to be able to give students an opportunity to highlight their commitment. Both, some have been doing it for years and others are just getting into it now. But nonetheless, they are very committed to helping to shape and improve the climate of their communities now and into the future, wherever that may take them.
There are some annual big-time events that occur, namely the jazz concerts on Sunday, and then on Monday the student conference, which you mentioned, Ignacio, the march, and the community scholarship dinner. But the planning committee works really hard to include some new ways to commemorate Martin Luther King Jr. What's the mix of events like this year?
We have a wonderful mix of events, starting with Sunday, January 15th, the concert that is hallmark, if you will. As you had mentioned, we have several of those hallmarks. There's two showings, 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. for the Jazz Spirituals, Prayers, and Protest concert. And the theme this year is the human movement, Earth, Life, Justice, and Music. And so we've seen the evolution of these themes kind of evolve to a point that is in sync with national issues again. And so that Earth, Life, Justice, and Music is really a reflection of that. And so we're honored to be able to have folks from different faith communities also coming together. So we have Muslim, Jewish, and Christian in particular that have already committed to being able to come to help close out the concert in a unifying communal voice, saying that we may disagree, we may be from different parts of our community, but we are all one, and we want to move forward together. And so that spirit is really part of the entire weekend, and leading into Monday, we have the first thing on the docket is a twist on what is normally a day of service. MSU is known for having a strong community service and civic engagement aspect, and so the Center for Service Learning and Civic Engagement every year partners with the outside campus community. But this year what we're doing is we are bringing the campus community to MSU. We have community partners, nonprofits, and the like that are all coming that morning bright and early, 9 a.m. to the MSU Union. And that is going to be, they're calling it the Make It, Take It, March With It, Display It, and Finally Act On It. And that is in reference to students and community members. This is open to everybody in the community of all ages to be able to come out and learn about some of the key components of MLK, his message, and the legacy, really the work of what is yet to be done, the unfinished work, so to speak, of movements for civil rights and human rights. And so folks can come out and almost as a teach-in. They're going to be sharing some information there. And then folks will have the opportunity to make their own sign. There will be some pre-designated templates that have the hashtag break the silence. And they will be able to break the silence, so to speak, on their particular issue that they can creatively display above on the sign. And so that is, again, open to the entire community, and it starts that morning there. And that leads directly into our Pachacacha presentations or Pechacucha presentations, which are really powerful, quick presentations. And these happen to be focused on social justice, civil rights, human rights issues, and they're all presented by MSU students, graduate and mostly undergraduate students there at the Student Leadership Conference. The additional element that we added to this conference this year is we have had limited opportunities for conversations among the conference participants in the past, and this year we expanded that. So we, in between, woven in between the presentations are challenging questions about the state of our community, and they're allocated time to be able to discuss not only the presentations they just saw, but also the question that prompts them on these issues. And they have proven in the past to allow for some of that rich dialogue to get to know your neighbors and to get to know your community members, both college students at the table, some faculty staff, majority college students, and then we'll also have some high school students. One particular group of high school students this year is coming to us from the just up the street, about 45 minutes away, and they actually have school on this day. And so unlike most of the nation that elementary schools, K through 12, have off, they have it on. And so they're wondering, why do we have it on, and what can we learn in this context of what it's all about. And so they're coming and joining us as well. So it's going to be a rich conversation from high school students, college students, all the way on up through professors about these social justice issues and these issues that are important to students. And so there'll be some meaningful dialogue, and hopefully what will happen is networks will expand and knowledge of people that are different from you will also grow, and that will build bridges within our community. And the last event I want to highlight for that day is the Commemorative March for Social Justice. This is an annual march that the entire community participates in and is invited to. It's completely free and open to all. We have grandparents all the way down through elementary school students join us, and it is going to be this year, 3:15 is the start time for that, and it is at the MSU Union, and we will be marching around West Circle Drive. So there's all kinds of fun and we'd like to involve everybody out on this event.
Again, another full docket and a wonderful mix of events for this year's annual Martin Luther King Jr. celebration. Ignacio Andrade is the Community Outreach Coordinator and Student Liaison at the Office for Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives. He is coordinating the 37th Annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Commemorative Celebration here at MSU. Thank you so much, Ignacio.
Thank you.
For more information on this year's celebration and to see a complete list of all the events that Ignacio just mentioned and more, visit inclusion.msu.edu. Events are open to the public, as Ignacio mentioned, and many are free. Martin Luther King Jr. Day is January 16th. Classes are canceled, but the university remains open. For MSU Today, I'm Jennifer Orlando.
WKAR.
Hello, I'm Ken Nobis, president of the Michigan Milk Producers Association. Dairy farmers in Michigan celebrated the 100th anniversary of our cooperative this year. Since MMPA's beginning, when the founders of our cooperative first met at Michigan State University, MSU has been an important partner to MMPA. And we are very proud to be honored this fall as a key partner of Michigan State University Extension. The Key Partner Award, presented at MSU Extension's annual conference in October, is given to those who have helped support and expand MSU Extension programs. MMPA received this award for their longtime support of MSU and for the partnership this year to help families statewide. MSU identified three accomplishments when they honored MMPA. First, our partnership with MSU has educated dairy farmers about the latest technology in the industry, thus helping farm families achieve success. Second, we work together on 4-H programs for youth across the state. These programs help people from all walks of life learn more about Michigan agriculture. And third, our cooperative worked closely with MSU Extension to provide healthy food to families that were affected by the Flint water crisis. This included several milk donations to Flint families earlier this year. None of this would have been possible without a close partnership between Michigan's dairy farmers and Michigan State University. We are proud of our work together, and we are honored to be named a key partner by MSU Extension for 2016.
AM870 WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman. It's easy to peer into the unknown and worry, to look in the rearview mirror and regret. We can become paralyzed if we imagine some inevitable future pain we must endure, fearing that traumatic scars, real or imagined, will damage us beyond recognition. We sometimes choose to give up on a dream rather than risk the heartbreak inherent in the inevitable failures that show us the way to making them come true. How can people find seemingly unending reserves of energy and courage to try again and again, even as an objective mind tries to convince a subjective heart to give up? The Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung challenges us to remember, I am not what has happened to me. I am what I choose to become. Those choices can make all the difference. Choose to believe that the scars are nothing more than tattoos with better stories. We are all warriors, and every warrior has them. Choose not to be a victim of your pain and struggle. Choose instead to go into battle to become someone else's hero. To paraphrase Emery Austin, some days there won't be a song in your heart. Choose to sing anyway. Choose to concentrate only on the one time and place over which you have total control. Choose how you react to the here and now. A very small percentage of people in this world will actually experience and live today, writes Steve Maraboli in his book Unapologetically You, Reflections on Life and Human Experience. So many people, he says, will be stuck on another day, another time, that traumatize them and cause them to spiritually stutter, so they miss out on this day. As for future fears, Bishop Beelbe Porteus gave us the wisdom in the 1700s. He said, he who foresees calamities suffers them twice over. And oh, how we love to live anywhere but the present. We'll hear a song that reminds us of how we mishandled a relationship and we relive it like it was yesterday. We'll see something that brings back a painful memory and replay the tape inside our heads at full volume. If at first we don't succeed, we may try again. But most things worth achieving require lots of trying. Fear of failure raises its ugly head and does its best to frighten us into losing focus, shutting down, avoiding necessity, giving up. So what do you fear? What triggers past regrets? When you step outside of your conscious mind and look at your fears from the point of view of a witness instead of a participant, how are they different? It's actually essential to allow yourself to fully feel the fear, to examine the root causes of your sorrow and regret. But do so with the wisdom of the now. The gift of experience is context. With time and reflection, we can forgive others and ourselves for past mistakes. We can feed the energy of faith that manifests the courage to do what needs to be done. Everything we experience can help us more clearly understand the suffering of others and develop a deeper appreciation of what we were put on this earth to do. It's easy to picture courage as a powerful echo across the canyons of doubt and distress. This isn't necessarily so. Author Marianne Rademacher tells us that courage does not always roar. Sometimes courage is the quiet voice at the end of the day singing, "I will try again tomorrow." So whatever your current situation, your task is to make your life a work of art that will be admired and inspire others. It will be hard work, but anything exceptional requires exceptional effort. Some long-forgotten sage threw down this gauntlet. At any given moment, you have the power to say this is not how the story is going to end. And there is only one moment in which you can write the next chapter. The now. I'm Scott Westerman at scottwesterman.com. Now you've heard it. Go out and do it.
WKAR.
Hi, I'm Jim Zook, Executive Director of the Michigan Corn Growers Association and the Corn Marketing Program of Michigan. Corn growers in Michigan depend on exports to boost markets for our product and ultimately keep family farmers going strong. Ag exports are directly responsible for hundreds of Michigan jobs, and corn is a big part of the success story. This fall, Michigan had a unique opportunity to encourage those strong trading relationships. We helped host Export Exchange, an event held every 2 years that brings together nearly 200 buyers and end users for corn and grain from more than 30 countries around the world. This includes all of the top U.S. international grain markets. For corn growers, it's a chance to meet and directly interact with these international customers. This year, Export Exchange was held in Detroit. Michigan's corn growers took full advantage of the opportunity. In addition to helping host the event, we provided opportunities for our international guests to learn more about Michigan corn. We hosted 6 trade teams throughout the state, giving buyers a chance to meet family farmers in Michigan and see their operations firsthand, and also visit our ethanol plants to learn more about DDGS as animal feed. As we look ahead to 2017, exports remain critical for Michigan corn. We're doing all we can to keep those relationships strong as we head into next year.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear the show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.